Expressed in our talk shows are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WGCH Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Greenwich Entrepreneurs. I'm Greg Skidmore, president of Bellary Asset Management, and my co-host from Withers Bergman this morning is Philip DeGeniro. Good morning.
Good morning, Greg.
And I think if you go to Withers Worldwide, they can see a picture of you.
Yes. No, I wouldn't recommend it before breakfast.
Our entrepreneur this morning is Humayun Beji.
Beji.
Yeah. You know, I'm programmed to say that because I made the same mistake the last time I had you on. But anyway, he is an ex-IBMer, and like a lot of IBMers or ex-IBMers, he has become a successful entrepreneur. And his company focuses on speaker recognition, which is very different from speech recognition. Most of us are familiar with, you can talk into some software and it'll spit out text. And Humayun's software does something different. If you speak, it'll hopefully pick up your signature and say, "That's Philip DeGeniro." So anyway, welcome. Good morning.
Well, I hope it doesn't do that because not every time. Yeah, because
only
it was
him.
Right. Yeah. Good morning. This is Humayun Beji. We do speak error recognition, and even in the field of speech, if you ask somebody to tell you what speaker recognition is, most of the time they'll come back and tell you it's a transcription program, which it's not. And what it does basically tries to recognize who you are. In certain cases, we call it identification. Sometimes we call it verification, depending on if you're actually providing an ID. So, for example, if you come up to me and say, "I'm Greg," and then I'll put that ID that you gave me together with your voice, and it'll make it easier for me to verify that you are indeed Greg. So, or let's say you have some other piece of information that you can provide in addition to your voice. Identification is a little bit of a harder problem where you have a whole lot of people in your database and the person walks up to you or, you know, picks up a phone and talks and you have to identify who this person is. So you really have to match him or her against the whole database and find out who it is. So verification is more... verification could be hard at times too because... you can't just, verify the person against a model. You have to also verify him against some sort of a negation of the model.
It's not a control group necessarily.
Exactly. So you have to know how much you're not Greg, mm-hmm. as well as how much you are Greg.
You gave a great analogy. I mean, humans are good at this by nature. You gave the analogy, if Philip calls me, and if I know Philip pretty well, I'll be able to pick up that it's Philip DeGeniro pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Without him saying, "Hi, it's Philip DeGeniro." Now, if someone calls me who I rarely talk to, and I don't know very well, I probably won't be able to, identify their voice. So humans are good at this, and now the trick is getting computers to do what humans do.
I think what you just touched upon is pretty interesting in the sense that we usually don't do identification. If I actually gave you 1,000 voices and said, "Try to identify this person," you'd probably do very poorly.
Oh, really?
So what we do is we do something in between. You know that there are a handful of people who are going to call you. So you have this very limited number of people that you're going to match against. So it's not exactly speaker verification where the person says, "I am this person." Even if they pick up the phone and say, "Hi," you only have a choice of maybe 50 people or 20 people who may call you in a day.
Right.
If somebody calls you, one of your schoolmates from 20 years ago calls you, then there's a high chance you're not going to be able to recognize this person right off the bat. You have to get more information to do that.
Well, I have two problems. One, I have to recognize the voice, and two, I have to remember the name.
that's another thing, yeah. Well, we don't have that problem in the computer world, but
right.
Because you just look it up. What it entails is that once you have a large population, that becomes a very hard problem. And I don't think it's anything that humans can do either.
And
so if you have like 1,000 or more than that.
So the application of it is, there's a lot of applications.
Of course.
Some of the ones that we discussed before the show was that, if someone walks up, it can be used for security. Somebody walks up to a door and they want to get access to an area, and a computer correctly identifies that person's voice signature and then lets them in the room. I mean, that's one application, right?
Right. The access control. Access control is one. Forensics or other applications where you're trying to find out who this person is based on just a voice sample that you have, you know, either for legal purposes, for and like that's something that you have to be, like a fingerprint, but you have to be very careful with that, just like fingerprints, that they could be wrong, voice could be wrong even more. So you have to be really careful. So when sort of legal oriented organizations approach us, I always make them understand that you can't just cuff somebody based on their voice print. You really have to have a lot of different pieces of the puzzle, and this will just be one little piece that you can add to that. Another thing that's really big with financial institutions, they haven't really, it hasn't picked up, but I think it's something that once it does, they'll see how beneficial it's going to be. You know, you call your bank right now, and they ask you all sorts of questions about your social security number, your mother's maiden name. And as they accumulate data, it actually becomes dangerous. Because what happens is that with the more they try to keep you out, the more questions they ask. So they ask you, what was your first elementary school? What was the street you grew up on? When were you born? All these things. And if you actually accumulate these with all this stuff going on with like search engines accumulating data, think about
this.
It
becomes easier and easier to steal your
identity. It'll be probably much easier. You probably don't remember some of these things because you may have looked it up because you just didn't. What was your first phone number? You know, stuff like that. Or like, what was your first car?
Yeah.
So they'll know so much about you that's going to be dangerous. So I think if you just use the voice of the individual in addition to some very superficial questions. I mean, for example, I can ask you a question on the phone. Let's say you're calling your bank, you're calling, you know, Visa or MasterCard, and they're trying to verify your identity. So, as the agent is talking to you, first of all, we can listen, the machine, not we, but the machine can listen in passively and try to make sure that you are the person because you've already probably entered your card ID. So it can at least sort of limit the space and make sure that you're close to that person that you say you are. And then it can actually display something on the screen for the agent. And the agent can, based on the confidence level of the software, can ask more questions or not. So the thing can say, I'm really confident it's him or it's her.
Right.
Then basically the agent will just go on with the rest of the stuff. And if not, then they can ask you more questions. One thing that you have to be careful about is liveness, because I can record your voice and I can play it back. And, you know, with today's technologies, you know, the recording is going to be just as good.
Right, right.
So to be able to alleviate those problems, what we usually do is we work together with speech recognizers, which is the thing you were talking about, which is a transcriber, where we ask questions randomly. And say, for example, if you're on the other side of the phone, I can ask you questions like, is it day or night where you are? And I know probably from like a caller ID where you're calling from. And if
you could ask, you know, what's the most recent check you deposited or something like that.
What I'm saying is you don't even want to go that personal. If I ask you that simple question, is it day or night?
Yeah.
If you answer, water's clear. I don't know. Something that's completely off the wall, has nothing to do with this.
You just say yes.
Right? then I know it's not you. I mean, then I know it's not live.
Someone's
you're not
your
really
voice.
Responding to my voice. So as long as I can actually find out that you are live and you're actually responding to my questions, that's all I need.
Right.
Then I can use the voice itself.
And you can probably match that. I mean, I know a lot of the firms that also, you know, you register your phone number. So they you know, one level of security is this person calling from a known phone number, and then of course they have their other security steps.
That's true. This is going to be just a little piece of the puzzle, but if you actually put it together, it's gonna do a lot for you.
Now you guys, you know, Philip and Humayun, you guys were talking a little bit about the challenges of patenting technology,
intellectual property.
Thank you. You know, Philip, what are some of the challenges of a small business when they're starting out with some proprietary, you know, technology and protecting it?
It's cost. I mean, I think any small or emerging entrepreneurial business is going to tell you that the cost of protecting your IP to the fullest extent of the law is an expensive proposition. And that's probably the biggest barrier. But There's more to it than that. I mean, let's just talk about cost first. I mean, if you're going to hire an intellectual property attorney to help you file a patent or a trademark or a service mark or copyright something, et cetera, that their time is going to cost you money, and also the filing fees with the United States Patent and Trademark Office. You may also be filing with the state agency.
And renewals.
Yeah, and of course renewals. But I think a common misconception about the patent process or intellectual property protection is that once you file and you have, you know, your piece of paper or your certificate from the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office of the state, is that you're good to go. And that's not the case at all. All you've done is define what your property is. You now have to protect it. The burden is on you as the owner of that property to go out and fight off anyone who might tread upon it or steal it or co-opt it in any way. So that's the other expense that really isn't quantifiable from the get-go. But Humayun brings up a great point, which we were talking about before, which is even the process itself of defining what your property is, you're kind of giving away your secrets, in a controlled environment. Obviously, you're disclosing what it is because the government wants to know what the secret sauce is so they know what their patenting is something unique. But you're also putting the world on notice as to what that is, and then people can build off of that. They can reverse engineer it. They can
just change a little bit of
exactly.
it, and then it's a completely new thing.
Right.
But they've started with all the base that you gave them.
Right, and you talked about a great business strategy, which is obviously a balancing of the risks and rewards, but it's at what point do you decide it's better off for me to formally patent something or get a trademark or a service mark, or should I just kind of keep it as a trade secret? It's proprietary. It's still mine until someone, takes it. But, at least I haven't put the world on notice and I haven't started the clock. I mean, every patent, has a time.
What is it, like 18 years?
Yeah, exactly.
Years,
I think. So let me ask a question because I just don't know a lot about this. So let's say somebody else comes along with some speaker technology and they decide to patent it before you have because you're keeping yours as a trade secret. And you look at it and you go, that is exactly what I'm doing.
Well,
what are the rules?
The reason I said what I said is that regarding my business, I mean, things are different for different people.
Sure.
Discoverability is the most important thing with patents. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but that's really important. If you can't discover, if you can't just by looking at thing, discover what they're doing, then it's not worth patenting.
Okay.
So, and the thing is, most of the stuff that we do is algorithmic. It's not even patentable under patent law. But a lot of big companies do patent algorithms by sort of putting a little bit of like salt and vinegar or something on it and saying that this is really part of a big process and we're patenting the process, but in the process includes these algorithms. But what I'm saying is that if it's something that's completely discoverable, so if it's a process, if it's say, you take your cell phone and you do this and you do that, then you want to patent it because then they can copy it and you'll know it when they copy it.
I think with a trademark, if someone trademarks after you do, but you were using it first, you can there's still some protection.
Yeah, there's some common law protections.
Does that work in patents?
Correct me if I'm wrong. My understanding is that it's not only that you patent it, but you have to also put it into practice.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are the first person who patented it and the first person who put it into practice, you're the one who gets it. If you put it into practice like 6 months in advance to the advance of the other person, but he patented first, and if you can show that you put it into practice, then I think there's some sort of
The policy behind most of these intellectual property laws is to avoid confusion in the marketplace, and that goes to the timing issue to a certain extent. If you're out there marketing, Recognition Technologies Inc. as a name of a company, for instance, and you've done it even though maybe you haven't registered that as a trade name, you're going to have certain rights and arguments, if you will, to protect it if someone then files a trade name, Recognition Technologies Inc., after you've been out in the marketplace. Because the law and public policy says we just don't want consumers of that service or that product to be confused. It's just about building, an argument.
We had one occasion with my other company, actually. It was a name that we had. We had trademarked Commerce Made Easy, and somebody else had E-commerce Made Easy. Sort of the same time, and we came to an agreement that basically we're doing two different things, we're in different sectors, and it's fine. So we coexist. So there are coexistence.
Yeah, I've negotiated coexistence agreements for exactly the same name, One was in Texas and one was up here, and they were doing different things, but the geographic differences. And we just agreed to have a link. If you want this, if you're looking for the people from Texas, click
it's like
on here.
Cisco. There's a supermarket thing, you know, called Cisco and Cisco routers. They have nothing to do with each other, right, so they coexist. I mean, they spell it differently.
Right. Reasonable people can come to reasonable agreements. In a
That's
perfect
a good
world.
Point.
Yeah.
So let's take a quick break, and but when we come back, you know, we'll continue. So anyway, here today with Philip DeGeniro, who is the co-host from Withers Bergman, and also Humayun Beghi from Recognition Technologies, and we'll be back in a second. 1490 WGCH.
Can you make these statements with confidence?
My investments are structured to maximize income tax savings.
My assets are secure from future creditors.
My compensation package protects me against management changes.
My estate plan efficiently passes my wealth on to my children.
My philanthropic aspirations are integrated into my plan.
Clients of Withers Bergman can say yes. Their lawyers combine tax, business, estate, and investment planning to reduce taxes and protect assets. With over 300 tax and other business professionals, they address the many complicated issues that successful people face. Visit withersworldwide.com or call David Lane at 203-302-4100. That's 302-4100. David Lane is admitted to practice in Connecticut. Other attorneys in the firm are admitted to practice in New York.
Welcome back to Greenwich Entrepreneurs. I'm Greg Skidmore, president of Bellray Asset Management. Our entrepreneur this morning is, you're a doctor. I didn't realize that. Dr. Humayun Beghi, who is a specialist in speaker recognition. And Philip DeGeniro, who is...
I'm also a doctor, juris doctor.
Oh.
JD.
Wow.
So, you know, show some respect.
All right. I'll wear a jacket and tie next time. I'm speechless. Anyway, Humayun, before we get going... Can you explain our watch to you? Your watch to us?
Oh, my watch. Oh, yeah. It's a binary watch. What's one of those things I got at like, there's this place called ThinkGeek.
Okay.
It's a binary watch. It shows the hour in like binary numbers. Ones and zeros. Yeah. That's it.
Wow.
It keeps your mind going.
When you're the adjunct professor of mechanical engineering at Columbia, you can wear a watch like that.
That would lock my mind up.
Yeah.
I'd have to control alt delete to get out of that. But anyway, so let's go back to your background. Your current business is with your wife, and you were at IBM. But you and your wife have been entrepreneurs since you got out of school.
She got out of school. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I got my PhD at the end of 1990, and I joined IBM right after that. IBM Research in Yorktown Heights, T.J. Watson, and I was working on handwriting recognition. I'm actually a mechanical engineer, and in mechanical engineering, Columbia is a little bit of an old school in the sense that signal processing and control are under mechanical engineering mostly control, and I studied control systems in mechanical engineering. Most other places have them under electrical engineering, so a lot of people ask me, you're a mechanical engineer, what are you doing with this stuff?
And right,
that's
right, right.
really the explanation if anybody, you know, thinks about that. But right after I finished, I joined IBM Research was working on handwriting recognition. So you'd write on a tablet, and it was online, and it would recognize what you wrote. So it's sort of like speech recognition, but for handwriting. And
so it was like what the early Palm was trying to do and the Newton and things like that, where you would write and
exactly,
convert
yeah,
the text.
Exactly. And it was actually, we were working on the unconstrained problem. That means you can write any way you want.
Okay.
You don't have to use a specific alphabet or write discreetly or anything like that. So you just write script.
And that's a tough problem. I mean,
it's a very tough problem.
It's not totally solved yet, right?
It was actually pretty good. I mean, we had a system that would do about 90% accuracy, word level.
Did you
accuracy.
Have to hold it in a backpack on your back, or was
No, it was very small. Okay. IBM had a tablet PC back then in like 91, we used to use that. It was black and white, but then they had a color version come out. The challenge was to be able to put the tablet, the digitizer tablet, behind the LCD. And that's been solved, you know, for many years. But at the time, it was cutting edge. And the we were working on algorithms to actually do the recognition.
Mm-hmm.
And as you may summarize, it's actually very similar to speech recognition.
It's
a signal
coming in. So it's signals. So
it's a signal. Okay. It's a 2D signal coming from tablet. Okay. And it's in time also because online. So you actually, in time, you're getting XY coordinates coming through. And in speech, you're just getting the speech coming through against as a function of time. You're getting the amplitude of the voice coming through as a signal of time. So they're very similar once you go past that first processing. After that, you know, you're working with handwriting, you're working with words and dictionaries. With speech also, you're working with words and dictionaries. In between, though, you're working with, like, ligatures in handwriting. With speech, you're working with phonemes. So they're very similar to each other. So that's why we worked with the speech recognition group a lot at the time. Then they decided to can the handwriting thing because just it wasn't making that much money for them. And I moved to the speech recognition group at that time.
So I want to fast forward just a little bit. Yeah. So you started working on speech recognition a long time ago.
Yeah.
But your wife and you also had a side business. I mean, it was your wife's full-time business, but you assisted with
it. In 96, my wife graduated from Columbia. She got her master's from operations research in Columbia. And she wanted to go get a job, and sort of we discussed it and decided that it's better if we start a hosting company. Back then, you know, it was pretty new. So we got a T1 in our house, and we started doing a host, you know, sort of hosting websites for people. And I cleared it with IBM. It wasn't really anything that they were doing, so there was no conflict of interest. So I helped her out. We had that business, and we still have some customers who used to be working with me. My old manager is still a customer, actually. anyway, so we did that until about 2000. We had a very nice account from Merrill Lynch Research in doing optimization of portfolios, 35,000 variables real time. So we were working with matrices of 35,000 by 35,000.
Oh, wow.
And we actually solved that problem for them in about a year and a half of budget that we got. And that's the reason I left IBM, because we had this very good project coming in. But then in 2001, in September, when they hit the World Trade buildings, their Merrill Lynch Research was in World Financial Center, which was right next door.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't sure if the buildings were going to be okay or not. So they all moved out, you know, the group didn't exist anymore. So that's how I changed into doing speaker recognition again. So it's going back.
Was that a tough transition? I mean, you know, did you lose a lot of business after 9/11?
Well, that one business was huge.
Okay.
We actually made a product that was working exactly like one of our competitors, which was in the business for about 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
It was worked exactly the same, but faster in the sense of the speed. And at the time, Merrill Lynch was paying about $250,000 per license for each of these things that they were using. So we were supposed to replace that. And losing that, you know, when we actually spent a year and a half creating the software was huge. Yes,
yeah.
It was huge. But then I decided, you know, I'll just go back to doing speaker recognition now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I started doing everything from scratch, you know, doing our speaker recognition engine, about 2001.
You've been working on the engine for about 9 years?
Yeah.
And I sort of have two questions. One, how has your target market changed? Did you assume certain people would be interested? Is that still your target market for customers?
We have one customer that is our biggest customer at this point, which is a language proficiency company,
mm-hmm.
which became our customer in 2002,
mm-hmm.
and is still our customer and still using our engine for verifying people who call in to take a test to show their proficiency. They verify that they're indeed the person who's supposed to take the test and not a friend.
Got it.
And they're a local business, so that. Actually, they've helped us in the sense that it's a give and take. Basically, they grew at the same time as we did, so we're sort of growing together.
Interesting.
They're getting sort of much bigger in terms of their coverage. And we are also, I mean, we have a very nice arrangement that we get the data from them. So we have access to a lot of data to be able to
And that's a private company. And
that's a private company.
You're also looking to do work with, you know, the government.
Yeah,
the government
we have, we've had, just in the past month or so, we've had quite a few government agencies approach us. As I was saying, you know, I think there's probably something out there. There's like a project or something. They're all trying to get a part of this. Government is going to be really benefiting from something like this. Financial institutions are also, we're talking to a few financial institutions, large financial institutions.
Now, Philip, do you have clients that do business with the government and some, I mean, what's the difference between dealing with the private sector and the public sector?
Yeah, I do. I mean, it's funny. I just been working on a project for a private security company that does a lot of government work and works with, you know, hospitals and entities that are quasi-government or municipality. Dealing with the government, it's a mixed blessing. I mean, I think most people say the government's a good payer. They're a good, reliable customer once you can land them. It's the bureaucracy that everyone complains about. It's mm-hmm. the red tape of actually landing them and getting them in as a client. You might work with someone, you know, who's telling you, yes, I like your product. I like your services. I want to engage you. I like the price. I agree all the terms. I got to get a purchase order. I got to run it through procurement. I've got to get 50 signatures to actually start. That's the lead time. Well, from start to finish, it must take, you know, months and months.
But for that purpose, I should correct myself. It's not really the government directly that we're working with mostly. Mm-hmm. I mean, I am on panels
government
sometimes.
Government contractors.
It's really government contractors. So you need that buffer as a small company. Otherwise, it's just really mind-boggling the amount of work that you have to do to be able to get the money at, you know, so
you need someone to expedite and,
yeah.
and people who are in the business of being government contractors and deal with subcontractors are going to be a great help to small business.
So we have 2 minutes left, so we sort of have to start winding down, but I think Phil, you know, you and I have seen that, you know, one of the areas that small business has been growing is that, you know, government's spending more now than they were a few years ago, so mm-hmm. they're opportunities for small businesses to sell to the government that may not have been there before.
Absolutely, especially if you're in the sectors that the government is prioritizing, like security and things like that. It's one of those things where I think opportunity lies and can be there for small businesses.
So, Humayun, do you want this company to be global someday? Do you want to keep it small and focused on research? What are your hopes and dreams for the company?
Well, I'm really interested in the research part of it myself. So I really don't care that much about, like, you know, growing, making millions, and then just having to deal with like the business end of it that much. But you know, I really like the research that I do.
Yeah.
So probably mid-size. I don't know.
Good. Well, that, you know, it's important to know what size you want to be, because
right.
then you'll you won't outgrow yourself. But anyway, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And I think if people Google speaker recognition, they'll find something on Wikipedia about you, and also you've got a website, www.recognitiontechnologies.com.
Or speakerrecognition.com.
Okay, or speakerrecognition.com. Anyway, Philip, thanks so much for being here.
You're welcome.
Visit Philip at withersworldwide.com. And this has been Greenwich Entrepreneurs 1490 WGCH.
Voice of Greenwich. This is 1490 WGCH Greenwich.
ABC News Now. I'm Karen Chase. Retail sales were up in April, but only by 0.4%, a big slowdown compared to the 2.1% surge in March. It was the seventh straight monthly increase, sparking hope that spending can support the economy. President Obama will express his anger and frustration over the still leaking oil well in the Gulf in